The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Lisa Maxwell for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Good Old Days. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the November-December issue of Good Old Days magazine. Since Thanksgiving is celebrated this month, I do have two Thanksgiving-related stories that I want to read for you today. The first one is titled, Turkey Treat for Two. Nobody chomped into a turkey drumstick with more gusto than my father. With turkey grease dripping off his chin, he looked like Fred Flintstone chomping those giant pterodactyl legs. Thanksgiving was a favorite holiday for our family with our focus on the bird. We had turkey only twice a year, Thanksgiving and Christmas. I was 11 years old and normally a picky eater, yet in November 1961, I longed for slices of turkey breast with celery dressing and canned cranberry sauce. For Daddy, his favorite was meaty drumsticks glistening with deliciousness that he craved to gobble up. His boyhood chum, Roger Powell, owned a turkey farm in Bay Village, 70 miles from where we lived in Fremont, Ohio. When we went to visit, I liked seeing the turkeys up close and enjoyed getting to keep feathers I found on the ground. Daddy was a salesman for Gascon Paper Company. At Thanksgiving and Christmas, he treated his customers to a Powell turkey. Roger was related to the Gascon family and gave him a good deal. Fresh dressed turkeys were moister and more flavorful than the ones hard as bowling balls piled high in the frozen food case at the grocery store. Daddy delivered the turkeys personally. Mama and I rode along when I was on Christmas break. The truck of our Mercury would be filled with brown cardboard boxes printed with a drawing of a turkey wearing a tuxedo and top hat. Inside the boxes were the dressed turkeys. Daddy's customers would be expecting us. We pulled into their driveways and then Dad hopped out into the cold and grabbed a turkey from the trunk. When the recipients answered the door, Mama and I would roll down the windows and wave. Come in for some holiday cheer, some invited, but Daddy wanted to finish his deliveries. Leaving without going in was disappointing, as I was curious to see the inside of their houses. Please, just for a little while, I begged as Daddy backed out of another driveway. Mama and Daddy easily and expertly ignored me, but that was okay. There were more stops. Usually, Thanksgiving dinner was just the three of us. However, one year, much to my delight, Mama invited Daddy's sister, her husband, and their two girls. I couldn't wait to have my cousin Irene and her foster sister Paulette come to our house. For Thanksgiving, Daddy preferred ordering a hen for us rather than a tom because a hen was smaller, yet still provided leftovers. However, since Uncle John was going to be at our house, he ordered a tom. On Wednesday night, Mama boiled the giblets and neck. This was an after-supper snack for Daddy. She saved the liver for Thanksgiving's gravy. Early Thanksgiving morning, I observed Daddy's face as he watched Mama rub butter on the huge drumsticks of this gorgeous tom. It looked too fat for our oven, but Dad hoisted it in to roast low and slow. He counted down the hours. To keep his mind off the turkey, he peeled yellow turnips and chopped them into chunks for mashed turnips. Our house smelled heavenly of roasting turkey when Uncle John and family arrived. Irene and Paulette were a couple of cutie pies, both younger than me. Mama couldn't resist kidding Uncle John about a new hit song on the radio called Big Bad John. As we sat down to dinner, Daddy had the honor of slicing the turkey with the carving knife we used twice a year. "What's your pleasure, folks? White or dark?" he asked, always the perfect host. Mama and I called out, "White." Uncle John and Aunt Julie chimed in, white too. My cousin, sitting across from me, joyfully screamed in unison, the drumstick. Mama and I instantly looked at each other. Oh, no. Daddy's longed for drumsticks, and he wasn't going to get to eat them? Thanksgiving was a time for sharing, but not my poor daddy's drumsticks. Skillfully, he carved the drumsticks off, magazine picture perfect, with golden brown crispy skin. I watched him carry and drop the enormous juicy drumsticks onto my cousin's plates. Seeing them made the girls giddy, and once their slippery fingers got a good grip, they merrily raised the drumsticks in a toast and had a little sword fight. I wanted to cry. The legs were top-heavy in their little hands, and they managed only a few nibbles. Nevertheless, Daddy got a big kick watching his nieces tackle them. He sat down with a smile and his plate of white meat. When Daddy was a boy, he grew up poor. He was thankful just to have something to eat on holidays. Soon, the girls were eager to zoom in on pumpkin pie. Seeing the cold, barely eaten drumsticks was harder on Mama and me than it was on Daddy, I think. We just knew how much he looked forward to them. He didn't even get one, said Mama to me in a pained whisper standing at the sink. However, my cat, Percy Ann, was in for a treat. No fishy-smelling Puss in Boots cat food for a week. She was the lucky recipient of the skin and meat feast left on the drumsticks. Fortunately for Daddy, Christmas dinner was only 4 weeks away and roast turkey was on the menu. And the next story I want to share with you is submitted by Elizabeth Wagoner, and it's titled, The Day the Turkeys Came to Town. Hurry up, Bet, my sister Tot was urging. I want to see the turkeys. I hurriedly dried the last of the plates and stacked them in the cabinet and soon was ready to hit the road. It was the late 1940s. I was 7 and Tot was 9. It was spring in our valley in the foothills of the Smoky Mountains. Our Aunt Vina had ordered some turkey chicks from Sears Roebuck and Company, a company that sold everything, from baby diapers to prefab homes, from their huge catalog. And they had just been delivered according to the grapevine, and we couldn't wait to see them. Her plan was to make a little extra money with the birds, since her husband was a traveling preacher with a lower income than most. People were beginning to celebrate Thanksgiving in a big way in Happy Valley, and she had heard turkeys were the big thing. Perhaps by then the turkeys would be ready to market. Of course, turkeys have been a staple of American table since the 1800s, but in rural Tennessee they had not made an appearance, and Aunt Vina aimed to change that. In that remote area, most everyone farmed, even if they held an outside job. We grew and canned vegetables and fruits and raised hogs, cattle, and chickens for food and for sale. We ate well, but most of us had never seen a turkey. What do turkeys look like? I asked my big sister as we headed barefoot down the dirt road to Aunt Vina's. Tot knew everything. Right now, they will look like a weird baby chicken, she said, but they grow very big, maybe twice as big as our hens. They got long necks and long legs and, you know what a rooster comb looks like? Well, they have that, but it is big and long like Uncle Joe's beard. I toyed with that for a few minutes until we got to the creek that we had to cross to get to Aunt Vina's. As we walked across the foot log, we could see the chicken house and excitement mounted. Through the chicken wire around the pen, we watched Aunt Vina as she got her new arrival settled in with food and water containers. There were dozens of them, and I felt sad that there was no mother turkey to be with them. Every day, Tot and I made a trip to see these novelty birds at Aunt Vina's. Then the spring rain started, and for days it poured. Finally, there was a break, and off we went to visit the turkeys. But the pen was empty and silent. Running to the house, we wanted to tell our aunt they must have gotten out, but that wasn't the case. What she hadn't known was that young turkeys are pretty clueless. When it rained, they went outside and raised their heads and opened their beaks skyward, perhaps thinking the rain was food being dropped in their mouths, and many of those baby turkeys drowned. Right there in the pen, standing on their feet and stretching their necks. People will say that's a myth and doesn't happen, but it did. Aunt Vina opted to keep the remaining turkeys as barnyard fowl with her free-range chickens, hoping they would learn from them. She also learned that turkeys, like chickens, grow and reproduce quickly, and in a few months she could double her flock. She would have many turkeys by next year. That Thanksgiving, most of the Valley folks feasted on chicken and ham, as country folks had always done. Aunt Vina decided to roast one of her now-grown fowl for that special dinner. As always, kin folks gathered for occasions, and we were invited to Aunt Vina's for our first Thanksgiving turkey. Before the meal, as always, Uncle Jim gave the blessing. He was a preacher and often prayed very long prayers, but today it was a swift and brief prayer. For this food we are about to receive, we thank thee, Lord. Bless it to the nourishment of our bodies and our bodies to your service. As for this turkey that we've never had before, he opened his eyes and looked dubiously at the golden bird for a moment. Thank you for it too. Amen. We've had turkey every Thanksgiving since. The next article I want to share with you is from Good Old Days on Wheels, and it's titled Henrietta. We all have our dreams. If we're lucky, we're able to find a way to make our dreams come true. My husband Steve had a secret dream, and he made it a reality. He wanted to be the proud owner of an antique car. Since he was a little boy, he had carried on a love affair with cars. As he was a man of few words, I wasn't at first aware of how strong his feelings were. I found out soon enough. We weren't wealthy and lived from paycheck to paycheck, so he knew the only way he would ever own an antique car would be to build his own. His father had a big garage in the back of his house. This was the birthplace of what eventually became a 1929 Ford sedan that was dubbed Henrietta, after Henry Ford, I suppose. It began with an old logging tractor chassis that looked like it belonged in a dump. It had belonged to a friend who was grateful to get rid of it. The detective work was begun by spending weekends driving down country roads with our son Michael, who shared his father's love of cars, searching for abandoned wrecks of old Ford bodies that looked like they had possibilities. This didn't happen overnight. The search was endless. Because of my father-in-law's business, which was Steve Rona's Excavating and Grading, my husband had access to a dump truck, which enabled him to bring an old 1929 Ford body into his father's backyard garage. This was the lucky break he was hoping for. A farmer from North Brookfield was willing to part with it for a mere $75. This 2.5-year process was so amazing, none of us really believed he would ever accomplish this seemingly impossible task. With tons of perseverance, pieces were discovered that were authentic 1929 Ford parts. Bit by bit and piece by piece, Henrietta took form and eventually made her debut. Her glossy, dark green exterior was the result of 11 coats of hand-rubbed liqueur. The upholstery was olive green mohair, which brought to my mind the mohair living room furniture from my childhood. Because Steve joined the Model A Ford Restorers Club of Massachusetts, our Sundays were always filled with excursions to interesting places. We, including our three children, Steve, Michael, and Patricia, were part of any parade that wanted us, and there were always car shows where Henrietta inevitably would win a trophy. As interesting and entertaining as all our destinations were, the trips to and from were also part of the fun. The car became an important part of our family's life that lasted for several years. The awards that Henrietta won over the years would forever be reminders of those Sunday afternoons when the world was a happy place and every face that turned our way had a smile on it. Our next story is entitled Remembrances of the Husking Bee, and this is submitted by Marianne Ramaker. If you lived on a farm in Wisconsin in the 1940s, a husking bee was something you might have looked forward to, or maybe not. When fall came, it was time to harvest the corn. Some of it went into a silo where it eventually became silage, which is fermented corn, and this was used to feed the cows. The rest of the corn stayed out in the field to dry into hard corn or dried cobs, the kind that you see today sold for squirrel food. Back then, the hard corn was picked by hand. When I was 9 or 10, Dad and Mom would have to find extra help to pick the corn because it was too hard a job for someone my age. It required someone taller and stronger. To harvest the corn, you would snap the corn, as they called it, and then throw it onto a wagon. When the wagon was full of snapped corn, it was taken home and dumped onto the cleared barn floor or into the shed. Once all the corn had been picked, which tended to be near late October or November, it had to be husked. So Mom would call together a husking bee. As all the corn was piled into the center of the barn, Mom would bury prizes in the pile, perhaps some canned corn or tuna or some towels or gloves and so forth. Then she would invite lots of friends, mostly from the city, to the husking bee. Sitting on overturned buckets or stools around the big pile of corn, the workers pulled off the dry husk and put the corn in another pile or on a wagon. Mom and Dad hung lights in the barn, and people brought blankets to wrap around their legs. There was some beer or hot coffee and sandwiches and chili to eat. Everyone told stories and jokes as they worked, and they had a great time. I think we kids mostly ran around, not really husking that much corn. As the adults husked, they found the prizes to take home. No one ever expected to get paid. They just came for the fun and fellowship. Perhaps you would be invited to another farm to their husking bee. Nowadays, I don't believe you ever see this task unless someone has garden rows of corn planted for their own use. Thus, after using machinery became common, the husking bees disappeared. Annette Cochera submits our next story, which is titled The Odd Back Porch Room. In the early 1940s, my father extensively scouted neighborhoods in Niles, Ohio, in search of a much-needed family home. He managed to purchase a place on Highland Avenue, although it was actually too small for our family of five. Amazingly, my resourceful parents compensated for close living quarters by utilizing the basement as a place to cook, eat, and play. The arrangement accommodated us well, and our secure little home offered comfort and bliss. Routinely, the rear door on our back porch was used by everyone entering and exiting our house. The many individuals who used that back door appeared oblivious to the odd lone room which had been added to the right side of our back porch. Its only entrance was through a solid wooden door which faced our busy porch. The peculiar room provided no admittance to our space-deprived home. It was a room to nowhere. By the time I turned 6 years old in 1945, I'd become curious about the second door on our back porch. Neither I nor my four-year-old brother, Carmen, could reach the hook, which was snuggled into an eyelet to keep the door securely closed. Our sister, Theresa, however, at 9 years old, had grown to a height that enabled her to unlatch the door. She did so and introduced her siblings to the interior of the mysterious room. The room's wooden floor held boxes filled with rags, discarded clothes, and old books. A musty smell prevailed, and one glass pane window faced the backyard. Carmen found the room to be scary, but Theresa and I remained intrigued. One day, Theresa brought some of Mom's modern screen and photo play magazines to read in the back porch room to pass time until lunch. She allowed me to join her, and we sat on boxes, flipping through pages featuring Carol Lombard, Ginger Rogers, and Lana Turner. Engrossed in scanning magazine pages, Sis and I were unaware that someone had locked the hook into the eyelet on the outside of the door. When we discovered we'd been shut inside, I began to cry. But Theresa, a fan of Houdini through reading tales about him, was herself an accomplished escape artist. She brilliantly put her thoughts into action. Theresa retrieved a thin piece of cardboard from the room's rubble. She proficiently slid the strip of cardboard through the narrow space between the door and its frame. Then she pushed the cardboard strip upward, forcing the hook out of the eyelet. Later, a playmate, amazed by our getaway, confessed to locking the door. She said she had planned to release us before lunch. Playing in the basement was fine, but weather permitting, I sought outdoor adventures. I didn't have to go far. I discovered that the odd outside room had unlimited opportunities for constructive play and eavesdropping. The porch room had latticed wood fencing that surrounded the crawl space beneath it, and a section of loose slats next to the porch steps created enough space for me to slip through. Beyond the latticed barrier, I entered what I thought was a deserted area. A surprising discovery awaited. As expected, the crawl space revealed a dirt floor, but there was much more. At the far end, I found a wondrous cachet of small, colorful bottles of different shapes and sizes. Some days, I would treat myself to my secret hideout and amuse myself by filling and emptying the treasured narrow-necked containers with dirt. I was in my glory. Theresa was too tall for my secret hideaway, and Carmen wasn't aware of what existed beneath the room he feared. I think the most satisfaction came from eavesdropping from my convenient crawl space. Kneeling in the dirt beneath the porch room, I positioned myself to face the backyard when Mom and the neighbor ladies chatted and gossiped close by. Unseen behind the wooden lattice, I got the latest reports, rumors, and tattles. I learned who was expecting a new baby, what community events had been scheduled, and bits of local and national news. Mom never knew about my spying operation, but maybe she did wonder how I knew so much without being told. Sadly, but on a happy note too, in 1949, my parents were able to remodel our well-established home. The porch and dilapidated odd back porch addition were removed. In their place, a new kitchen and bedroom for my sister and I were built. But never fear. The odd back porch room was not demolished. Dad moved it to the far corner of our backyard and constructed its missing fourth side. After that, it was used as a storage shed. It remained there right up to the time our family moved across town when I was a junior in college. Personally, I feel that back porch room enhanced my early childhood in multiple ways. It served as a playroom, while its crawl space enabled uninterrupted playtime and concealment of my presence during opportune times. The experiences enriched my young mind And today, thoughts of those times broaden my smile. From the bits and pieces section, I've got two pretty short articles that I want to read for you. The first one is titled Family Store on Wheels, and it is submitted by Annette Kuchera. In 1952, I panicked the night before starting classes at McKinley Junior High in Niles, Ohio. Only then I realized I had no pencils or paper. Consolingly, Dad telephoned his cousin Frank, who promptly delivered my school needs. Frank was a dignified businessman who operated a store on wheels. At a time of one-income families with stay-at-home moms, few in our neighborhood owned automobiles, so Frank's business was thriving. From his van, he sold condiments, medicinal aids, cleaning supplies, and other household products. Through his efforts, Cousin Frank, his wife Mary, and their six daughters shared a beautiful large home and lived well. And next, we have Reba German, who submits a story titled Riding My Pony to School. Some of my best memories are of riding my pony Pansy to school. I started school in the fall of 1939 at the age of five. I fed and watered my pony every day. My parents bought Pansy for me to ride to school, which was 3 miles away. My pony stayed in a shed at the school. Dad put a saddle on her every morning for me. Sometimes I fell off, but it never hurt me. Pansy would stand and wait for me to get back on. Pansy was a spotted Shetland pony just 36 inches tall. When the weather got bad, Dad would take the back seat out of the car and put Pansy in back, and I'd ride in front with Dad. We moved when I was in third grade, and I started fourth grade at a new school. I either walked or Dad took me because the new school had no place for my pony. Pansy lived to be 37 years old at my parents' farm. She was a wonderful pony, and I loved her and have fond memories of her. And next, I have some flashback fun trivia for you. The Mr. Coffee brand of automatic drip brew coffee makers became available for home use in 1972. In 1973, Joe DiMaggio became the spokesman for the brand, and more than 1 million coffee makers were sold in 1974. First Lady Mamie Eisenhower introduced pink into her home decor whenever she could, so much so that staffers referred to the White House as the Pink Palace. We have run out of time for today's episode of Good Old Days. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Lisa Maxwell, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Good Old Days is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please call 919-832-5138. And again, that number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.